it just opened up a lot of imaginative thinking that nobody had ever perceived before.
This is a sea story unlike any other in our own times. The true story of the most perilous voyage ever made by a Navy in peacetime.
I thought it was magic.
This is the log of an epic voyage. Here, from the ship's tape recorder, are the actual voices and sounds of one of the greatest navigational feats in history. A voyage that cut 5,000 miles off the sea route from Asia to Europe and gave the United States and her allies the naval supremacy of the top of the world.
It's amazing to think that less than 100 years before Nautilus went under the North Pole, the Confederate submarine Hunley was propelled by seven men sitting along the length of the submarine, turning a crankshaft with their bare hands.
The whole business of the impossible dream involved in a frontier operation is unique, that this was a whole new game and we were pioneers, and wasn't that exciting? That's what brings miracles.
Nautilus 90 North. Nautilus 90 North. Aye,
Captain. Sunday, 3 August, 1958, 23:50, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, the North Pole.
This is our story of a submarine called the Nautilus, illustrated by recordings made by her crew on three historic voyages. Nautilus was the first ship to be driven by nuclear power and the first to sail submerged from the Pacific under the ice-bound Arctic Ocean to the North Atlantic via the North Pole. It was a feat only performed in fiction by an earlier Nautilus, the creation of the French novelist Jules Verne in his 19th century classic, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It's the story, too, of an American legend named Hyman Rickover, a crusty, controversial captain in the U.S. Navy's engineering branch who turned a dream into reality and a turning point in the Cold War of the middle 1950s.
Yes, sir.
I'm ready.
Lieutenant Jimmy Carter. The future president had graduated from the U.S. Navy's academy at the end of the war. After 2 years in surface ships, he transferred to submarines, and in 1952, after passing the obligatory interview with Captain Rickover, Carter joined the U.S. Navy's nuclear elite.
Except for my own father, Admiral Rickover had more to do with shaping my life than any other man, as he did in all the other young men also who served in the U.S. Navy in the nuclear armada. Rickover was a complete nonconformist. He was so dedicated to his unique and unprecedented effort to bring this strange new scientific development, that is atomic power, into useful purposes, that he ignored rudimentary requirements, protocol, and procedures in the Navy. He was obsessed with his own work, and when he was demanded to give obeisance to his superiors and to fill out enormous piles of forms and to comply with the Bureau of Ships regulations, that he just refused to do so.
Were you frightened of him?
Yes, I was frightened of him. Everyone who dealt with Rickover knew that he was extremely demanding. He abided by no mistakes. He expected other people to work as hard as he did, which was almost impossible. And he knew more about all of our jobs than we did ourselves. It was almost impossible. It was impossible to measure up to what standards he provided for us.
Oak Ridge, Tennessee, home of Manhattan Project, birthplace of the atomic bomb, and the spot where 50,000 persons kept the war's greatest secret. In this mile and a half square, the foundation of a new age was laid.
In 1946, the U.S. Navy sent Captain Rickover to watch over its interests at Oak Ridge, where the U.S. Army and Air Force were building up a stock of nuclear weapons, their number then limited by a world shortage of uranium. Rickover was not concerned with bombs. His idea was to use atomic energy to power ships, and he very quickly focused on the submarine. As he saw the future, it was the vessel in which nuclear power would make the most significant difference. It would allow a submarine to stay submerged without the need for air and batteries to operate its engines. This would also be the most difficult application of nuclear power. If a reactor, in those days the size of a city block, could be scaled down and fitted into a submarine, its installation in bigger ships would clearly be feasible.
It was very clear that this would revolutionize warfare.
Ted Rockwell was a senior member of Rickover's engineering team.
Just the fact that you could take these ships anywhere and be there without people knowing about it, you could even operate under the polar ice where people can't find you. That was very, very clear to him with his submarine background. He was qualified in submarines. That would revolutionize warfare. The official policy in the United States was that this was not a worthwhile program. Top scientists like Teller and Oppenheimer and so forth had made a formal statement that there really wasn't enough fuel, enough uranium in the world to take care of even the bombs that they wanted to make. And it was foolish and premature to think about propulsion engines. They refused to give it priority. The whole word out was that he was on a crazy program that didn't have any future.
Navigator, recommend we go down and speed up.
Novice, 10% physics, 90% engineering. And it is engineering, really. I mean, the physics of the thing had already been well known, except you had to put it in submarine.
In the early 1950s, with so little known about nuclear power reactors, the idea of being locked up underwater for weeks on end in the company of a supply of uranium, the key element in the most destructive force made by man, must have seemed sheer madness to many. The reactor Rickover and his team were designing was not to be bolted down in a laboratory or a power station. It had to work in a warship, where the crew might at any time have to abandon the rulebook and take unusual action to survive. Hence, Rickover's insistence, first, that his designers consider every conceivable operational emergency, and secondly, that all nuclear submarine officers and every engine room rating would spend a year studying nuclear energy and reactor engineering before they went to sea.
Nuclear power demands a high degree of excellence in the construction and in the operation, and the operators stick very closely to the written procedures and so forth. By having the first application of nuclear power be with submarines, you had a people whose culture had that emblazoned in their brains, that on a submarine, every person knows exactly what his duties are in each case. If there's a rig for collision drill, or if there's a fire, or there's a battle stations, or whatever the mode of operation is, the submariners know precisely what they're supposed to do, and they don't have any hesitancy or ambiguity about, gee, maybe somebody else can get that valve, and I don't have to bother with it. But that's their life, and they understand it, and they understand that their life and the life of everybody else on the ship depends on their doing that. So having that kind of a character to start with was a tremendous asset to nuclear power, because that became the way everything was done. If they had started with people that had experience in running a conventional power station, they'd have had a very different breed of cat.
Shut down the reactor.
Novice, 10% physics, 90% engineering.
Another of Rickover's recruits was Harry Mandel. As a wartime engineer officer, he'd worked with Rickover, and he now became one of the two or three top civilians designing the reactor in a desert site in Idaho, far away from possible interference by opponents of the project at the highest levels of the U.S. Navy.
One school of thought was, well, it's on land, we've got plenty of space, let's build this thing so there's lots of room between the components so we can go and walk around them and so forth and see if the concept really works. Another school of thought was, you're going to put all these components in a submarine. So even if I get something working, which is spread out, if you want to call it, that's no proof that when I have to redesign those components in the submarine, that they'll work. So finally the decision was made, and a lot of blood spilled on this, was to build a submarine hull at the prototype site in Idaho. Put all the components and design the components that would fit in that submarine hull, which was a duplicate of the Nautilus hull.
The key to success at Idaho came when the team's prototype reactor reached criticality. That's the point where the nuclear chain reaction becomes self-sustaining.
At Idaho, where the land prototype was, Rickover kept saying, I know you guys are geniuses and you think you got all the answers and you think you know exactly how much uranium it takes to go critical, but humor me, give me a little more, I want to make sure it starts up. And I said, Admiral, you know, I want to make sure it shuts down.
All right, sir, we'll take the reactor up to power. Safety rods out at 1021.
Rickover's feeling was, let's run this plant for 100 hours at full blast if we're going from here to England, for example, and see how it stands up. And people were a little concerned at the time. This is brand new. We don't know enough about it. But he said, hey, we've got to have a practical plant. This is not a plant to be handled by physicists and doctors and this or that. It's got to be a plant that the sailors can take and operate and run it. I've got to find out what its weaknesses are.
That was in 1952. 10 months later, at New London in Connecticut, Nautilus was launched by America's First Lady, Mamie Eisenhower, a demonstration of support for the project on the part of her husband, the Commander-in-Chief.
You're all ready now, are you, Mrs. Eisenhower?
Aye. Now?
All right, here she goes. Wait a minute.
The Navy really wasn't interested in this thing. They were convinced it was never going to go anywhere. As a matter of fact, the day that the Nautilus put to sea, there were guys in CHINFO, as they call it, which is the Navy Public Information Office, were calling up some of their reporter friends and saying, hey, go down and cover this thing, because this guy Rickover has been getting all his publicity, and this is where it's the whole bubble is going to burst.
She should go.
Because when people see this ship, it's just a toy, you know, it's not a real ship.
No, not yet.
It's going to sink after pulled out of the way from the dock. You know, it was a big farce. But as a matter of fact, it was a ship that was ready to go to war.
There you go. Hit it.
There was a lot more to do. Until she could fit it out, Nautilus would be little more than shell. Her crew, though, had been attached to the ship for more than a year, watching, learning, constructing, and testing operations. Then, on the morning of the 17th of January 1955, Nautilus slipped her mooring lines and made for the open sea. From the bridge, her commander, Eugene Wilkinson, made a signal that became a landmark in the U.S. Navy's history. Underway on nuclear power.
Captain, this is the Chief Engineer, Engineering Department, ready in all respects to get underway. Ready to answer bells on both main engines.
Captain, acknowledge the work.
Captain Wilkinson did a great job of selling nuclear power.
Engineer Jack Kouros.
He just thrived on putting on a show for all our guests and drive that boat through the water as fast as he could. And he only knew one speed, and that was flank speed. He said anything else was going slow. He was the ultimate nuclear salesman.
Rick Navigator, we're taking departure. Recommend course 300, speed full. That's 300, speed full. Right.
Scattered around the ship, there are Geiger counters to keep track of radioactivity. Here, 20 feet from the reactor, there's no more radioactivity than in your broom closet. Inside the power plant, behind a thick jacket of steel and water, a charge of uranium is giving off furious energy. On a lump of fuel no bigger than a baseball.
Bridge, when you're ready, clear the bridge and submerge.
Bridge, I...
Aboard for the sea trials were the boat's godfather, Hyman Rickover, now a rear admiral, and his close associate, Ted Rockwell.
Being on a submarine when you're not used to submarines is an experience in itself. I mean, one of the things that they very carefully don't tell you, let you find out the hard way, is that there are certain temporary tack welds that are put into decking and so forth just to hold things in place. And when the ship starts to submerge, the hull is squished, compressed a significant amount. And some of these spot welds will pop open. Just pop over and allow the deck to slide a little bit. There's a sound like a shot that rings through the submarine. Nobody seems to be panicked. And you're looking around and thinking nobody is saying anything. And, you know, I'm not going to be the first one to yell. You just assume we're all in this together, guys. And if none of the rest of the experienced guys are excited, I guess there's no reason for me to be excited.
I'll add one third. All right, one third.
Compared to the conventionally powered submarine, stinking of diesel oil, sweat, and engine fumes, Nautilus was as comfortable as a cruiser. She carried no stack of batteries, no massive tanks of diesel fuel. She was fully air-conditioned, fitted out with a jukebox, a cinema, soft drinks and ice cream machines, a dark room, a library, a laundry, and a big mess room for the crew.
Well, it was being part of the first and finest, and we knew it. We were the first and the finest, much to the disgust of a lot of our shipmates on the older boats, because whatever they needed to make the Nautilus go, they got. And other boats were suffering for shortages of money, but the Nautilus always was provided for. And consequently, the word was along the waterfront, there she is, Lola. Lola wants, Lola gets.
It was like going from a shack to a palace in terms of crew habitability.
Leading sonar operator Al Charette.
A lot of room, very comfortable, air conditioned. You know, we always ran about 70 degrees, 72 degrees temperature and about 50% humidity. We controlled that fairly closely. You couldn't do that on a diesel boat. We did not have to snorkel. We did not have to listen to diesel engines. It was just amazing. It had all kinds of room. Every bunk had its own light, its own air-conditioned outlet. Didn't have to sleep alongside a torpedo. It was night and day.
We had a grand staircase that went from the middle deck to the upper deck in the operations compartment, and we were very proud of that grand staircase. We were the only submarine in the world that had one.
For every morning breakfast, we had eggs to order, and on Friday afternoon, we'd have a choice of steak or lobster.
Ship's cook, Tommy Dean.
We had fresh fruit and vegetables, and that's what the guys wanted. There's no other aspect of a submarine life that contributes more to the morale of the crew than sitting down for a good meal. It's a social event. It's the only social event that we have while we're underway.
Torpedo room con, we have a merchantman overhead. We'll simulate a torpedo run on this merchantman. Make ready tube number 3.
What would happen was we would operate with the fleet all week, and then on the weekends, starting Friday night, we'd come in. We wouldn't even get to the dock. They'd bring visitors out on a tugboat and meet us in the harbor and put on a load of visitors for a grand tour and a grand weekend at sea, learning and observing nuclear power firsthand. And it'd be a boatload of senators and congressmen, and away we'd go. Put it on a show Saturday, Sunday, and come back on Monday morning and drop them off, and away we go for fleet operations again.
All right. The torpedo room con, open the outer doors on tube 3.
Boardroom on. Con, boardroom, outer door on tube number 3 is open.
We were at sea pretty much of the time, but while we were doing that, we were being told just how wonderful we were.
On her first cruise, Nautilus traveled 1,300 miles submerged in 90 hours, record. Her nuclear power plant had given her twice as much mileage as her designers had expected. She was refueled for the first time after 2.5 years in 1957. That summer, a new commander took over. William Anderson had made 11 wartime patrols in the Pacific. Under Rickover, he'd spent months asking himself whether a Nautilus could operate in seas that had defeated all comers, could sail safely under the unexplored ice of the Arctic Ocean. This nobody knew.
There was already a great deal of talk about the potential of the Arctic for nuclear submarine under ice operations, with its freedom from the Earth's atmosphere and ability to run submerged for very long periods of time. here might be the answer to extensive under ice navigation. So I undertook very quietly a program of study at home about the Arctic in order to become as familiar as possible about the area and the ice characteristics and what was known about water depth and so on. It had to be sold. There was enthusiasm among some of the submarine staff people in Washington and elsewhere, and then there was reluctance among some people, quite senior people.
There had been a succession of failures. In the 1930s, Sir Hubert Wilkins, an Englishman, had fitted an already obsolete submarine with overhead runners or skis. He was hoping to dive under the ice and surface in successive jumps in patches of ice-free water. But the underside of the ice, far from being flat and uniform, was jagged, and it smashed his skis. In World War II, a few German U-boats did shelter briefly just under the edge of the ice pack, but nobody tried to penetrate it. But with Nautilus now proving itself, opposition at the top of the U.S. Navy, mainly on safety grounds, was beginning to collapse.
It won out not so much on its own merits. It won out because we were going up to the North Atlantic anyway for a major NATO exercise, so we'd be going in the general direction of the ice pack. We would be able to pry a short few days to try her under ice, and finally, we were able to sell that under some restrictions. The Navy said that there had to be a buddy conventional submarine involved to stand by outside the ice pack while we were underneath it, on guard, so to speak. I'm a pretty careful submariner. I had a magnificent ship, and I'm really a terrific crew. And I was not about to take any more chance than we had to with that combination.
Far more important than a buddy submarine was the inclusion in Anderson's crew of a physicist, Dr. Waldo Lyon. He had worked for years on the theory of under-ice navigation. He developed a system that would turn out to save lives. It worked by bouncing sound from the submarine's hull upward to the ice pack above to fix the sub's position below the ice and hopefully help avoid a fatal collision, or, even worse, becoming trapped in shallow seas. But the Arctic was unexplored, and nobody ashore or afloat knew what to expect. Jack Kouros, engineer.
What we were going to do was make short excursions under the ice to test a whole variety of submarine equipment and our ability to navigate under the ice. The captain of the trigger asked how far we were going, and the captain sort of avoided the direct answer, but said we'd do as well as we could, probably get to where we could talk to Santa Claus.
We're in a new environment. Out in the open ocean, you've got wave noise and shipping traffic and all the rest of that. When you proceed under the Arctic ice field, all of that goes away. Initially, gets very quiet compared to what it was out in the open ocean. But then you start hearing other things that you hadn't heard before. There were different marine life up there, but the primary thing was if you were in an area where there were any icebergs or breaking up of ice, you heard this seltzer-like bubbling effect, effervescent effect. As icebergs rolled over, or as the ice fields jammed against one another and crushed against each one another and they broke up, all of the air bubbles in those sections of ice were escaping, and you would hear this effervescent noise. We had not experienced that before.
From 330 to 050.
The first problem we had was on our very first attempt to try our surfacing procedure. There was a lot of interest in that on my part and on everyone's because of the possible military application of that area.
We wanted to learn how to come up in a polynya. A polynya is a opening in the ice where the ice has come apart from moving and shifting and forms a little lake. The idea was to see if we could gradually come up and surface through one of these polynias, or at least get our periscope and our antennas up so we could communicate.
On ice summary for past 15 minutes was 10 tenths total coverage, made up of 4 tenths small flows, average thickness 8 feet, maximum thickness 25 feet.
The difficulty that we had that no longer applies today was that the only thing you could see as far as the ice was concerned is what was directly overhead. In other words, the fathometers pointed upward were just reflecting what was up above you. It was by mere chance that you would run underneath an opening at the time that the top of the ship should have, we thought, break through into clear, unfrozen water. We came to a shuddering halt. The periscope I was looking through blacked out. This was not open water, but ice. I did not do enough practicing. I did not do enough training, procedure-wise, and as a result, wrecked both of our periscopes. Just failed miserably, and not only that, but damage our ship considerably.
The problem was we were next supposed to, after ICEX, join up with the British and the French for a NATO exercise north of Scotland, and we couldn't very well do our part of the submarine without periscopes. So at the edge of the ice, we straightened out one of the periscopes. As we straightened it, we heard a sharp report, which turned out to be a large crack. We thought all was lost at that point, but being the ship's welder, I welded on the periscope for some 12 hours in the wind, and it was blowing 25 to 30 knots up there, and it was all freezing wind. And so we had foul weather gear on and hooded parkas, if you will, and then try to put a welding helmet over that. The chief of the boat and the gunner's mate constructed a tent out of some available canvas and wood. That allowed us to weld without much wind. However, it was cold as the devil, and you could only work for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and then you had to warm up. And we had, there was two of us that were welders, and we took turns alternately welding and warming up down below. And that went on for about 12 hours until we completed the repair.
What happens if you break something, if you impair the integrity of the hull? Boy, you're at it. Or if you, for example, bent the shaft of the propeller a little bit so that it jammed in the packing and it couldn't turn. Things like that, when you're under the ice and it's hundreds of miles to where you're not under the ice anymore. And at that point, nobody had ever tried to poke up through the ice. We didn't know how thick it was. No, that was a very, very courageous thing. I'm amazed that they hung on as long as they did before they turned back.
Well, after the periscope repair, we set upon what I had planned to be our longest trip under ice and proceeded to our target latitude of 83 north, and things were going well. So I decided to keep going. Well, we did. We were approaching latitude 87 north, in other words, about 180 miles short of the North Pole itself, when, thanks to incredibly bad electrical design in a particular circuit, we lost power to all of our navigation equipment, both compasses. Everything except the magnetic compass was thrown out. And at that latitude, the ability of a gyro to be restarted, even with the restoration of power, and to settle down and to be useful, was totally questionable. And that we found to be the case. We had to steer by a magnetic compass that has never been at home in a submarine, with all of its metal and electrical currents, and particularly up anywhere near the North Magnetic Pole. It wasn't too many hours till I had to tell myself, well, you know, we really have lost track of where in the hell the North Pole is. We're lost. So reluctantly, I reversed course and headed back for open water.
I think he was just courageous enough.
Nautilus had been submerged under the ice for 72 hours, covering a distance of nearly 1,000 miles. She'd sailed to within 180 miles of the North Pole. However, the Russians were also breaking new ground in space.
This is Radio Moscow.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world was today successfully launched in the USSR.
Sputnik shocked America. It boosted the space program and also the Nautilus project, which quickly became a top-secret venture with major implications for naval strategy in any future nuclear war.
There was a great need for a scientific advance or a scientific leap, if you will, to put us back in the forefront. And so this was it. We could demonstrate that we had the scientific capability to get to the North Pole and back safely.
Anderson's report on his maiden Arctic voyage was cautious. Within days of his return, he briefed senior White House aides and recommended a 2-year program of further exploration. But that was too slow a pace for President Eisenhower.
The president, incidentally, has not been given enough credit for being behind this voyage, enthusiastic about it, probing about the risk involved. He was the one who directed in no uncertain terms that this undertaking of a trip all the way across the Arctic from one ocean to another be kept in absolute secrecy, and that when it came time to announce either a success or a failure, that he would make the determination on how and what manner the announcement would be made. Well, when the president himself takes that position, he gets a tremendous amount of respect. We work very hard to preserve that secret. As an example, I was not able to discuss the operation with my own boss.
With your own boss?
With my own boss, I could not discuss the operation. I would say on your two hands, you could count the number of people knew about what we were trying to do.
What they were trying to do was hugely ambitious. Open up the fabled Northwest Passage by sailing submerged from the Pacific to the Atlantic by way of the North Pole. In the 6 months between her first trip under the ice and this second voyage, Nautilus was fitted out with better navigation gear, notably compasses and echo sounders. Secrecy was paramount. Anderson and Lyon had reconnoitred the ice pack from a small private aircraft, flying over it under false names. They even survived a forced landing in the middle of Alaska's wilderness. Meanwhile, the Navy had constructed an elaborate cover story involving a fictitious voyage to the equator.
We had to somehow account for the fact that we were going to be out of communications for a long time and people weren't going to hear from us.
Al Charette, leading sonar operator.
So the cover story was we were going to do a long transit south of the equator to do another first and then go back to Panama to go back to New London to cover up the period of time that we were going to be in transit over the North Pole. That we were collecting data for the Polaris program during that long trip to see how the crew was going to react during a long submerged non-communication period.
Her second voyage started badly. An engine room fire was followed by a leak in a condenser that took weeks to repair, and then a crew member died. There was also a bad omen. Not a single sighting of a leaping porpoise while Nautilus was leaving port. Only now was Captain Anderson able to tell the ship's company about their true mission.
All hands, this is the captain speaking. I have on board a top secret operation order. There are perhaps only about a dozen people in the country who know about this plan. Our mission is one of extreme importance to our country. Our mission is to proceed to England by way of the North Pole. So let's get the ship absolutely picked up during these next few days en route up to the ice area, and we'll have a fine cruise. Thank you very much, and good luck to everybody.
Their only good luck was their escape from total disaster. Nautilus did find a way under the ice, but within 48 hours she ran into trouble.
What was happening was the ice was proving to be about twice as deep as we had expected. We were encountering clearances of the ice that were decreasing to a mere few feet.
We had been experiencing what we call ice keels. These are wedged-shaped pieces of ice that float loose from the land. The one in particular that we went under extended down about 60 feet as we passed underneath this, and the needle on the upward-looking sonar kept coming down and down and down, closer and closer and closer to where the top of our sail would be.
I cautioned the diving officer when we increased depth by 20 feet to try to do so with a very little angle on the ship. If he had put on even a small amount of angle with the amount of clearance that we ended up below us, we could have dug the bow into the bottom or the stern.
We felt it was a good decision, but we were kind of dejected because we had to turn around. We're worked up to make this trip. Let's go. Everything's working perfect. The plant's beautiful. You can't ask for a better propulsion plant to do the job. And all of a sudden, Mother Nature says, hey, you can't do it.
Clearly, we were in a tough situation. I reversed course, realizing that we didn't know but what the next ridge ahead might prove to be impossible to clear. I didn't want to get that wonderful ship stuck in the ice. Now, we were able to extricate ourselves after a period of time and to eventually get back into open water where we could surface and send a radio message reporting our predicament to Washington. I was very nervous about what their reply might be. I tried to make my report to them accurate and realistic, but not pessimistic.
In his reports, Anderson was understating the danger he and his crew had been in. This for fear that higher authority would put a hold on the program. But there he was wrong. After a month in its base at Pearl Harbor, Nautilus cast off on its third and ultimately triumphant trip.
Although this was a top-secret mission and we had retreated and gone back to Pearl Harbor for a month, during that time, almost the entire crew was flown back in relays to New London for a long weekend. To this very day, we don't know that the word ever leaked out about what we were going to do on that trip. I have never heard a crew member say, oh yeah, I told my wife what we were going to do. To the best of our knowledge, that top secret mission remained a top secret mission until it was completed.
We departed Honolulu on the 23rd of July.
The reactor is critical.
Captain, acknowledge the word, sir.
Bridge navigator, after you clear the submarine base channel here, your first course out will be 301.
301, bridge eye navigator. Right full rudder.
Right full rudder.
Pearl Harbor signal tower.
301.
Bearing?
Bridge eye.
255.
Bridge navigator, you should be coming up on the Pearl Harbor range astern. When you're on it, your course out the channel is 153.
Channel course 153, bridge eye navigator.
Bridge navigator, you should have buoy 5 coming up a beam to starboard here, Charlie. Bridge eye
navigator. Everyone was offered the opportunity to not make the trip if they so chose. Because we certainly didn't want anybody on board who didn't feel comfortable. They become a bigger problem than the equipment that you're trying to maintain.
Bridge navigator, we're taking departure. Recommend course 300, speed full.
300, speed full. Bridge eye navigator. I help bridge, come right to course 300. Right, 300.
Once clear of Pearl Harbor, her crew painted out Nautilus's topside identity number, N571, and steamed ahead on the surface until the paint was dry. Then she dived. Her course was to take her through the Bering Straits and the Chukchi Sea. Both were dangerously shallow and inhabited by Soviet submarines. And on her port side, within periscope range, was the Siberian coastline. Passing the Diomedes Islands, she was close enough to pick up a local radio station.
Горы, поросшие деревьями уродливо изогнутыми над доском, реклый и ласковый мглой южной ночи. Горы важно забыть. И на пышные
жены.
Before going through the rather restricted channel between the Diomedes Islands and the Alaskan coast, we came up to periscope depth, put our radar up for about 30 seconds, pulled everything down, and we were on our way. If the Russians detected us, they're awfully good. From the Bering Sea, we penetrated through free water up to the edge of the pack.
The going was not particularly easy. There were places where the ice was, again, deeper than we had originally anticipated and deeper than anyone had even estimated. This was ice that had piled up on shore, broken loose, being the summertime, and drifted out into the ice pack, proving to be quite an obstacle. We would try one route and find that we couldn't get through. We'd back off, turn around and move over a few miles and try again. And eventually we worked our way up to just north of Point Barrow, Alaska, and were able to find a deep seawater valley that led into the Arctic Ocean itself.
During his earlier aerial reconnaissance, Anderson had talked to Alaskan seamen about their favorite fishing grounds.
They had this favorite area that they would go to, particularly in the summertime, and find that the fishing was unusually good, which to them indicated deeper water and more freedom of movement, more things to entice fish to be there. So putting that bit of intelligence together, we found, in fact, that they were entirely right, and there's a wonderful deep sea path leading into the deep water of the Arctic Ocean itself, just north of Point Barrow, Alaska.
The Barrow Sea Valley.
Bridge, when you're ready, clear the bridge and smart.
Bridge, I
we'd taken a lot of time probing around and wanted to complete the trip as quickly as possible.
One-third speed, yeah, trim satisfactory.
Navigator, I've got my cup. We got plenty of water underneath this machine.
To study the crew under conditions no American sailor had experienced before, the Navy High Command had insisted that Nautilus carry an extra passenger, a psychiatrist with the rank of four-ring captain, no less, named Dr. Kinsey. His assignment can't have been easy. As Jack Kouros remembers, Dr. Kinsey was totally out of his depth.
He was dealing with submariners, and they're a different cut of cloth, and we all worked very well together. All the different ratings, we just worked hard at making his life just miserable. He had a little card that he asked us what we were. The nuclear engineers took it upon themselves to pick out and only answer three or four words every day consistently. And those words were, I don't know whether you can air this, but those words were, we were blue, very blue, we were very bored, we were horny, and we were clutched up. We came very close to driving him crazy before he left the ship.
3 days after finding deep enough water, Nautilus was cruising at 20 knots towards the North Pole.
The name of the game was to make it to the open Atlantic so as to make a complete crossing of the Arctic Ocean, some 1,830 miles under ice. The pole was just, it's an interesting point on the Earth. It's a magnet that attracts explorers, but it's just one point on our route.
From the geographical North Pole center. This is the captain. In a few moments, Nautilus will realize a goal long a dream of mankind, the attainment by ship of the North Geographic Pole. The distance to the pole is now precisely 0.4 miles. As we approach, let us pause in silence, dedicated with our thanks for the blessings that have been ours during this remarkable voyage, our prayers for lasting world peace, and in solemn tribute to those who have preceded us, whether to victory or to defeat.
The jukebox shut off. The only sound aboard was the pinging of the sonars against the ice above and the seabed below the hull. Anderson, after the voyage and talking to us half a century later, was quick to credit his navigator, Shep Jenks. In fact, they carried that burden in harness, and by common consent, they performed miracles.
I really think that this is the most remarkable job of ship navigation ever done.
Stand by. 10, 8, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
For the United States Navy and the United States, the North Pole. Then we had a big party in the crew's mess. And there was a cake. We re-enlisted one of our sailors there. And who'd show up but Santa Claus himself? It was quite a time.
Merry Christmas to all of you. Well, let's see now, Chief Nicholas. Are you sure you've given me the complete list of all the boys and girls whose fathers are here on the North?
Captain Anderson wanted to report his position at the pole to Navy headquarters in Washington, but to use his radio, he first had to surface.
We didn't do it until we got to open water a couple of days later, where we could surface and transmit the encoded news to Washington. It took a good while to make contact, but I believe it was through Radio Japan that we first were able to get a signal through, get the word back home.
Message ready to go to Chief of Naval Operations, Nautilus 90 North. Nautilus 90 North, aye, Captain.
Nautilus 90 North. That's all we said, three or four words to indicate we had been at the pole.
From now on, Nautilus was on the home stretch, bound for Portland in England. She picked up speed, and so did events. Months earlier, the White House had arranged that if and when Nautilus reached Iceland, she would surface and rendezvous with a helicopter, which would pick up Anderson and take him to Reykjavik for an onward flight to Washington and a ceremony at the White House. There, this self-effacing man would meet the world's press.
I'm a little bit dazed right now because 14 hours ago I was submerged, 72 hours ago under ice, and only 5 days ago at the North Pole. Things are moving too fast. Right now, the Nautilus is steaming toward a Western European port with my extremely capable executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Frank Adams.
What was your overall mileage?
Overall mileage from Honolulu to the time that the ship will arrive in a Western European port will be in the neighborhood of 8,200 miles, sir. The trip thus far has lasted, I believe, 16 days. We have been submerged for perhaps 96-97% of the time.
The West European port Nautilus was secretly bound for was the Royal Navy's base at Portland in Dorset. By the time she reached there, Anderson had been flown back to his ship.
Fireboats out, shooting water into the sky, helicopters, a bunch of them, fixed-wing jets, a huge welcoming party at, they call it the coal docks, a big crowd.
We just had no idea that what we had done was of the magnitude that would get that response from the public.
We were overwhelmed by the number of people who wanted an autograph. We didn't think we had done anything significant at the time. It took a while for all that to sink in.
Incidentally, the person who determined where Nautilus would go as its first stop after the polar crossing was none other than the President of the United States, President Eisenhower. He specified that our first port should be a British port.
Among British visitors to Nautilus in Portland was a Royal Navy captain who was later to serve in Britain's nuclear fleet, John Jacobson.
This was a nice summer's day in August. It was altogether a new concept to go on board that ship. It was a wonderful experience. I remember my first reaction, which was, how clean this submarine smells. Because I don't know if you've been on board a conventional submarine after it's been submerged for a few days, you almost gag with the stench of body odour, rotting vegetables and diesel fuel. So to go on board Nautilus and breathe fresh air was my first sensation. The second was that you had a steam plant on board a submarine was something quite new for us. They were extremely careful only to reveal so much to us. And all the reactor plant information was top secret. They knew exactly what we wanted, and they'd invited us on board. And, of course, this was well outside NATO. This was the US-UK special relationship in action. And the collaboration was particularly close in the nuclear field, due to the wartime contribution that Britain had made to the atom bomb. And that exchange at scientific level went on. I think we'd have been at least another 5 years and probably longer before we'd produced our own working nuclear submarine without the Americans.
I'm coming home, baby, now. I'm coming home now, right.
Rear Admiral Hyman G. Rickover, renowned as father of the nuclear submarine, was on hand to welcome the Nautilus as the personal representative of the President of the United States. The citizens of New York raised their voices in congratulation, and their voices echoed throughout the free world.
I'm coming home, I know I'm overdue.
Back home in America, press and radio were celebrating Nautilus as a breakthrough on a par with the kind of enterprise later accomplished by the men who landed on the moon.
A voyage ends and an age begins. This is the golden era of undersea exploration. Man is invading inner space, the unknown oceans that cover four-fifths of his planet. The voyage of the Nautilus marks the way for cargo and passenger submarines cruising under the pole and peacefully beneath the storms of all oceans. These ships are making man the master of inner space.
But to the U.S. Navy, Nautilus was first and foremost the forerunner of the ultimate weapon, the nuclear deterrent, a floating hidden launch pad for ballistic missiles. The submariner we heard at the start of our story, Lieutenant Jimmy Carter, ended up with his finger on the button.
When I was a very young boy, if anyone asked me what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, I told them I wanted to go top of the Navy. I not only exceeded my ambition to be chief of naval operations, but I was chief of all operations in the United States military of all kinds. So it was quite a promotion for me.
If the Russians had, somebody had dropped a bomb in a first strike on the United States, would you, as president, have gone to the nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarine first in preference to the other two arms?
Well, I realized that fully, of course. I was familiar with the capabilities of our nuclear submarines when I became president and of the armaments that they carried. As a matter of fact, one of our Trident submarines, with its total number of warheads, we had the ability to destroy every city in the Soviet Union. So I didn't have any doubt that the submarine force was my foremost capability if, God forbid, nuclear war should erupt.